Oh, thanks very much for the invitation. It's always great to be here. I'm going to talk about some work done in collaboration with John March Russell, Ning Chiang Song, Stephen West, and I'll especially highlight Marco Gugetto, who's fantastic to work with. I don't think I need to convince anyone here that we have compelling evidence for the existence of dark matter, and there's a huge range of possible candidates that have been proposed, spanning an enormous number of orders of magnitude of possible masses. Lots of these ideas are interesting and have things going for them, but at least for me, a particularly interesting possibility to work on is the idea that dark matter could be a new particle with a mass of roughly less than about an electron volt, so that its wave-like properties are relevant for the universe today, direct detection experiments, and so on. Within this broad class, I'm particularly interested in two possibilities. First of all, the idea of an axion. This is a pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson of a spontaneously broken approximate global symmetry, or at least the analog in string theory. So it's a spin zero pseudoscalar if the symmetry is chiral. It's got an approximate shift symmetry, and the typical couplings to photons would be something like, typical couplings to the standard model would be something like an interaction with photons or with a quark current. I particularly like axions because they're especially well motivated from a high energy perspective. I don't want to put a number on it, but at least my bet would be if there is new physics out there, an axion has a reasonable chance of being what is existing. Or perhaps slightly less motivated, but also still interesting and certainly a viable possibility, is the idea of a dark photon. This is a spin one vector associated to a new U1 gauge symmetry. I give it a small mass, so at least at low energies below some scale, it has this action here. And a typical interaction with the standard model would be something of this form, some sort of kinetic mixing between the standard model photon and the dark photon. And then once I do a basis redefinition, this turns into a small coupling between the dark photon and the standard model electromagnetic current. A second reason that I'm interested in new light particles is that we can search for them experimentally and through cosmological and astrophysical observations. Just to give some indication, here's a plot of current constraints on the axion coupling to photons as a function of the axion mass, and the dark photon kinetic mixing as a function of the dark photon mass. Moreover, if you look at projections for future experimental searches, these are potentially going to cover a pretty large part of parameter space. Possibly some of these are a bit too optimistic, but at least a fair chunk of parameter space is likely to be taken out. This kind of brings me to my third motivation for working in this area. If this sort of experimental progress is being made with really a quite substantial amount of effort being put in to get down to sort of these kind of couplings, I think it makes sense that from a theory side, we should understand the pheno of these particles as much as is possible. And indeed, I think, of course, lots of stuff has been done, but I think there's a lot more to be done in this direction. In particular, today I'm going to talk about the possibility that an axion or a dark photon could have an interesting spatial distribution in the present-day universe with non-trivial substructure. So this is substructure bound inside the usual galaxies, galaxy clusters that we know. Just to get some basic definitions out of the way, I'm going to define the dark matter over density field delta of x in terms of the dark matter density at a point, rho of x, rho bar is the spatial average, and the density power spectrum is p delta. For people who work in cosmology, this will be super familiar. For anyone who's a pure particle theorist, it's nothing weird or surprising. It's just related to the two-point function of the overdensity field. The delta, direct delta function here reflects statistical homogeneity and isotropy, and the k cubed is just to make p delta dimensionless. So if p delta is roughly 1 at inverse length scales k, that means there's order 1 fluctuations on length scales k. Whereas if p delta is small, it means the small fluctuations. Okay, and preempting basically the rest of the talk, I'm going to claim that in many theories of axions or dark photons, initially the spatial distribution of the dark matter is likely to have this sort of form. So at large spatial scales, small inverse length scales, we have observations from CMB and things like that, so that we know the dark matter has to have the usual adiabatic spectrum of fluctuations. Indeed, any theory of dark matter that didn't have these spectrum of fluctuations, we could just throw out immediately. But then once you go to small scales, observations basically run out. We have no constraints. And in particular, it's totally possible that we could have large isocurvature components corresponding to initially order 1 overdensities. or in sort of cartoon form, this is supposed to be like a one-dimensional slice through the dark matter spatial distribution on a kind of log x-axis scale. So at very small scales, we have large fluctuations here. And then on large scales, everything kind of averages out and we only have the adiabatic fluctuations. Again, preempting in some sense the rest of the talk, I'm going to claim that actually this initial spatial distribution can lead to interesting substructure. So the peak here leads to objects that are extremely tightly bound, at least by cosmological standards. And in many cases, moreover, I'm going to claim are actually solitons, or what I'll call boson stars. These then get bound within compact halos corresponding to this part of the initial density power spectrum, which altogether are then bound into the usual astrophysical structures we know, which come from the adiabatic modes, of course. Okay, again, preempting, I'm going to claim that this is the case for, or at least could be the case for many production mechanisms for dark photons and axions, or axion-like particles to be maybe a bit more precise. It's certainly plausible, I think, that it's the case for all of these, but actually, in many of these scenarios, it's quite hard to calculate the initial spatial distribution reliably. Perhaps the most obvious case of that is a post-inflationary ALP, where there are many uncertainties, many things to worry about before you even get to the structure formation. So because of that, I'm going to use inflationary production of dark photon dark matter as a nice toy example. The real benefit of this, as well as being quite an elegant minimal model, minimal theory, is that everything at early times about the production is easily calculable. There's no uncertainties, so I can really focus on the later structure formation. And in some sense, it's supposed to be acting as a toy representative of these other theories. Yep.
What is for the production from local streams?
Okay, so this is the idea that if I have strings associated to the U1 that's giving rise to the dark photon, they can produce dark photon, dark matter.
Why aren't those very relativistic?
I think the story here is that you need a very small gauge coupling so that his strings look somewhat like global strings, emit dark photons pretty efficiently until late times. And then the hope is that the dark photons will be produced with momentum of order Hubble, so like the axion string story, they could form a component of dark matter. Okay, so inflationary fluctuations are the sort of nice toy model. I don't necessarily, well, maybe it has some theoretical problems if you're concerned about swamp line criteria and so on, but for me, it's a perfectly well-defined theory. I'm happy to work with it. Okay, plan for the rest of the talk is to just give an introduction to this scenario, following the nice work of these people. Then I'll talk about the way that the density fluctuations that I'll show form in this case, from this production mechanism, collapse down to solitons. And I'll say a bit about the subsequent structure formation and the survival of this substructure. I won't have too much to say about the signals because this is mostly work in progress. And if I have time, I'll mention similar dynamics in the case of axion-like particles. Okay, cool. So vector dark matter from inflation. Getting the unpleasant feature about this theory out the way to start with, I assume that this is the action of the theory. And I require that the mass of the dark photon, M, is much less than the Hubble scale during inflation, HI. However, I also need that this is the true action of the theory during inflation. So whatever dynamics give rise to this mass have to happen at a scale that is much above HI. I have to have a bit of a separation between M and whatever Higgs mechanism or Stueckelberg string theory realization leads to such a mass. But okay, it's a perfectly well-defined theory. I can work with it. And I'm going to call my scale factor of the universe A of t. Now, for a generic mode that is initially subhorizon during inflation, we have that the physical momentum at this time is necessarily bigger than Hubble by definition. And correspondingly, it's going to start off relativistic just because the mass is less than the Hubble scale. I can do the usual decomposition of my vector field into a transverse part and a longitudinal part. This is what the transverse part looks like. The longitudinal part, of course, has the usual definition. And then the action splits up into a transverse part and a longitudinal part, with the two decoupled. At least as long as the gravitational interactions between the dark photons are irrelevant, there's just a complete decoupling of the two. I won't go through the details because it's not too exciting, but the action of the transverse part has this kind of form. And then once I switch to conformal time, you see that actually the action that I end up with is time translation invariant, at least in the limit that the modes are relativistic, as I said on the previous slide. I ignore this term and then just everything stays the same with time translations. As a result, none of these modes are produced during inflation, which is a kind of standard result for vector fields. The longitudinal modes are more interesting. So in this case, the action looks like this. Taking again the relativistic limit and doing some redefinition, you see that the action that I get out just looks like a normal relativistic scalar. And it's well known that scalars are produced with a scale invariant energy spectrum at the moment of horizon exit. Or if I define the energy spectrum in the usual way, so this is the energy density of the longitudinal modes, then at the moment of horizon exit, we have that the longitudinal modes have the usual hi to the 4 energy spectrum per log interval. At this point, if you know about scalar fields, you know that scalar fields can't be produced as dark matter from inflationary fluctuations. They're just completely ruled out by these constraints on the density power spectrum that I showed before. But vectors evolve in an interesting way after inflation. And really, this is what Graham et al. Pointed out in their paper and showed very elegantly. Again, I'll skip some of the details, but the equation of motion of the longitudinal modes has this form and it has energy density of this form, where now the del squared is supposed to be acting sort of as if it's acting on Fourier modes. So implicitly, you can imagine this as think of this as acting on each Fourier mode. Subsequently, the evolution of the different modes is what really makes this theory work. So this is supposed to be a cartoon of the evolution of different modes, different co-moving modes, as a function of scale factor. So time is going to the right. At the bottom, we have modes that leave the horizon only right at the end of inflation. They subsequently are superhorizon and relativistic. And in this regime, you can show that their energy density goes down as 1 over a squared. They then pretty quickly re-enter the horizon while they're still relativistic, redshifts as radiation, and then subsequently eventually act as matter. Going further up, you have modes that leave the horizon a bit earlier, are superhorizon for longer before re-entering, and so on. And there's a particular special mode, K star, which exits the horizon such that it re-enters exactly at the moment that it's going non-relativistic. This is the mode 1 over K star. So this is the mode such that when the Hubble parameter is equal to M, so H is equal to what I call H star, K star over A star is equal to M, so the mode has just gone non-relativistic. Then as I go to smaller K, larger co-moving scales, modes exit earlier. And the crucial feature is that these modes are superhorizon and non-relativistic, which for a scalar would mean they had frozen energy density, but actually for a vector has an energy density that goes down as 1 over a squared. This comes from the 1 over a squared in this expression for the energy density, which ultimately traces its way all the way back to the metric in the original action on the mass term. And again, I won't show it in full detail, but probably from this cartoon, it's kind of plausible that the modes that are redshifted at least are these modes at K star. Modes that leave the horizon later have a longer era of being redshifted as 1 over a to the 4, whereas modes that leave earlier have more redshifting from this vector regime. Then going through and doing the sort of calculation in the standard way, you find that the energy density of the vector field in general is given by an expression of this form, so it's not too surprising. You have the Hubble parameter to the 4, you have some redshifting factor from the 1 over a squared redshifting, and then the 1 over a cubed part coming from when it's evolving as dark matter. Putting in numbers, doing all the factors carefully, you find that the energy density is about the observed energy density for masses of about 10 to the minus 5 electron volts and Hubbles of during inflation of 10 to the 14 electron volts, let's say. We know that the Hubble scale during inflation has to be less than, say, 10 to the 13 GeV these days from tensor perturbations, and that tells us that the dark photon can comprise the dark matter for masses of roughly bigger than 10 to the minus 5 electron volts, assuming a standard cosmological history and so on. Okay. Looking at the results from this production in more detail, we can define the power spectrum of the dark photon field in the standard way, similarly to the power spectrum of the overdensity field. So PA would be the two-point function of the longitudinal mode with itself. And in terms of this, we have that the energy density is given by some expression. But the main thing is that the power spectrum of the dark photon longitudinal mode is not surprisingly peaked at K star, as I kind of anticipated from that hand-waving argument before. Given that A is a Gaussian field, we can straightforwardly calculate the density power spectrum starting from this expression for PA. There's just some integral to do. And what we find is that indeed it is peaked at scales K star, falling off as K cubed at larger spatial scales and as 1 over K at smaller spatial scales. In contrast, a scalar field produced this way would just have a flat density power spectrum and completely be ruled out by isocurvature. Whereas in this case, the K cubed suppression is easily strong enough that by the time we get to these large cosmologically observable scales, it's far below the extrapolated adiabatic spectrum and doesn't conflict with any observations. So indeed, this is exactly the form that I anticipated earlier. If you look at small scales, say lambda star, which is 2 pi over k star, we have order 1 fluctuations in the density. This is again supposed to be like a cartoon or a realization of a one-dimensional field slice. Whereas if you look at very large spatial scales, you kind of average out all of these fluctuations and you just get small overdensities. And just to give some idea of the physical scales involved, if these things didn't clump into substructure but just redshifted and expanded following Hubble expansion, they would correspond to lambda star, which is the scale of the order 1 fluctuations, would today correspond to scales of like 10 to the 11 kilometers, or something like that, which is pretty large by some standards, but small compared to cosmological observables. Okay, now getting to the kind of interesting part which made it worth writing a paper on. If we have an order 1 overdensity in the dark matter, then this is going to become nonlinear and collapse at around the time of matter radiation equality. I won't show this rigorously, but it's kind of plausible that, imagine I have my overdensity in some region, it has some delta in dark matter, then at earlier times before matter radiation equality, most of the energy density in this region is going to be radiation, and in some sense it's going to evolve linearly as long as the radiation inside is larger than the dark matter inside, just because it doesn't care that there's a small overdensity in the dark matter because most of the energy density in the region is radiation. But this changes at redshifting of A equality over delta, which is the time when the order 1 overdensity will collapse, become nonlinear, and form a bound object. And the typical density, rho, will be roughly equal to the mean dark matter density at the time of collapse, given by this expression. So if I have an overdensity of size r, the first thing you could do, or the first thing I actually did at the start of the project, is ask whether the wave-like nature of the dark matter is going to be relevant in the bound object that forms. I'll show a more rigorous computation later, but a nice intuitive way you can check this easily is by asking what is the de Broglie wavelength of a particle in this bound state clump that's going to form. This is, of course, 1 over mv. V is the virial velocity I put in the expression for that, and this is what you get out in terms of the density. So there's going to be a critical clump size when lambda de Broglie is equal to r, at which the wave-like effects will matter for the entire clump. And then any clumps that are smaller than this will be dominated by wave-like effects. Any clumps that are bigger are going to be, the wave-like effects will be completely irrelevant. That's straightforward to solve. You get that the critical radius, which I'm going to call the quantum gene's length, lambda j, is given by this expression. From here to foot here, I've just put an extra factor of 4 in order to match up to another definition that will come later, but all of the parametrics are the same. And correspondingly, there's a scale k genes, the genes momentum, which is given as 2 pi over this, 1 over this, let's say. Actually, 1 over that in there. The conventions with the numerical factors don't matter too much. Okay, good. Now, the interesting thing, again, the thing that makes it worth writing a paper, is that if we compare the quantum gene scale, so the scale at which these wave effects matter, to the scale at which these order 1 fluctuations occur, k star, at the time of matter radiation equality, which is the time when the clump is collapsing into a bound state object, you get this expression. The numerator is just the quantum gene scale, the denominator is just k star, taking the fact that by definition k star are modes with momentum m at the time a star, redshifting forward to a equality. Then a over a equality is just given by the ratio of temperatures. T equality we know in terms of the dark matter density at the time of matter radiation equality. T star we know from the definition of star, that h star is equal to m. And we know what that is in terms of, well, that's g times t star to the 4 because it's happening during radiation domination. And now you can see that if you plug this in for a star over equality, basically everything is going to cancel out. And the only thing we get left with is the mean density in the clump divided by the mean dark matter density. So omega A divided by omega matter, where this is the energy density in the dark vector, in the dark photon, compared, and this is the energy density in, let's say, matter overall, including dark matter. And if I demand that the dark photon makes up all or most of the dark matter, this ratio is automatically 1. And in fact, when you go through and you do things a bit more carefully, putting in factors of relativistic degrees of freedom and so on, you end up with about 2. This is completely independent of the mass or anything else that I'm putting in. So it's just always the case that the order 1 overdensities are going to collapse in a regime where the wave-like effects are relevant. Okay, doing this slightly more rigorously, just to be careful, if we start off with the equations of motion of the vector field, then at the time of matter radiation equality, we can take the non-relativistic limit. So we write our components of the vector field in this way, just expanding out, and then factorizing out effectively the fast oscillations so that we switch A for psi, I just runs over 1 to 3 with the components of the vector field. The non-relativistic limit is just the usual thing. So the equations of motion and the Einstein equation reduced down to Schrodinger equation for the evolution of the modes, and then just the Poisson equation for gravity. And at this point, unlike the early evolution, AL and the longitudinal and the transverse degrees of freedom are now coupled together. So even though my field starts off longitudinal, it mixes in and becomes equally longitudinal and transverse, just based on the counting the degrees of freedom in each. We can make progress from this Schrodinger-Poisson form by doing a transformation. So we effectively move into a kind of fluid description where we have a three-component perfect fluid, which satisfies a continuity equation, and then an Euler equation. This looks completely like usual, with the additional feature that on the right-hand side, as well as a contribution from gravity, we have a quantum pressure term. So there's an effective pressure here with the quantum pressure, people call it, given by this expression here. You can see that this has a minus sign compared to the gravitational pressure. So in some sense, whereas gravity is causing the vector field to be attracted and clumped together, this is going to result in the origin of the name. Pressure is going to oppose the contraction or formation of clumps. Now, this quantum pressure is going to be negligible if we have that it is much smaller than the contribution from gravity, which is satisfied if this is the case. And okay, it's a straightforward computation, so I won't go through the details, but in practice, this is satisfied, so quantum pressure is negligible. If we are looking at scales k much less than k genes, where k genes is exactly what I defined before. So it's just reproducing the previous hand-wavy argument, but in a slightly more precise way. Overdensities that satisfy k much less than k genes are going to grow and collapse just in the usual way that any halo would, independent of the wave effects. Whereas, let's say, overdensities on scales k much bigger than k genes are going to oscillate and be prevented from collapsing by the quantum pressure. So going back to the density power spectrum, we now know how the different modes are going to evolve. The modes over here that are initially small, quantum pressure is negligible, so they're going to just grow in the usual way. They start off perturbative with delta being much less than 1. They grow linearly with delta growing as A over A equality until they reach delta is equal to 1, at which point they collapse into a classical halo. Meanwhile, these modes over here on the right-hand side with K much bigger than K genes are going to be completely dominated by quantum pressure. They won't collapse, they're just going to oscillate in some way. Whereas these modes right at the peak, with k is approximately equal to k genes, are going to be on the edge of being affected by quantum pressure. They're already non-perturbative at the time of matter radiation equality, and they're going to collapse at this point. And we expect that the collapse is going to be in the, as I say, a regime dominated by quantum pressure. So in fact, they will turn, we think they'll turn into things that are soliton-like objects. I'll define this more carefully in a couple of slides' time. The mass of these objects is going to be set by the dark matter density inside a typical fluctuation. So, well, inside a fluctuation that can collapse, which is roughly lambda genes, where lambda genes is the 2 pi over k genes at a given redshift. Perhaps not too important, but just to make sense of the simulation results later, k genes is not actually fixed, but it moves slowly to the right in this plot as time progresses. As the dark matter density goes down, just with the expansion of the universe, fluctuations further and further on the right stop being completely dominated by quantum pressure and then can form into clumps. It's only a power of a quarter shift, so it doesn't make too much of a difference, but it is there. So we expect that the clumps that are formed at a given redshift A are related to the mass inside the fluctuations that are allowed to collapse at this point, M genes. And to give an idea of the numbers of the modes that are collapsing at matter radiation equality, which are going to be the most interesting observationally because they'll be the densest, the typical mass is something like 10 to the minus 15 solar masses, or dark photon masses of about 10 to the minus 5 electron volts. For larger dark photon masses, we end up with smaller clumps, less massive clumps. And if we could go to smaller dark photon masses, we'd end up with much more massive clumps forming. Okay, again, just to make sure that I'm doing things kind of precisely, we can also do this a bit more rigorously, starting from this fluid description. So I can divide my objects into what I will call classical halos and solitons. In a classical halo, we somehow need to balance this gravitational pressure, and the quantum pressure is irrelevant, so the only thing that can support these objects is velocity. And we have just a usual halo that in some sense is supported by angular momentum. In contrast, in a soliton, the angular momentum is irrelevant, but we have that the gravitational potential is balanced by the quantum pressure. So we have phi q is equal to minus phi. The velocity is basically zero. And if you like, the object looks something like this. This is going to be almost my definition of a soliton. In slightly more detail, an actually equivalent definition of a soliton is it's the solution that minimizes the energy E given by this expression for a fixed value of the total mass in the dark photon. And actually, you can show that these can be obtained by rescaling some basic ansatz of this form. So this is psi I, which again is related to the actual vector field by the usual non-relativistic reduction. I've got some e to the I minus I gamma mt factor. Gamma is effectively telling me the binding energy of these solitons. Then chi 1 here is a density profile, which takes this kind of form. So the energy of the soliton is pretty well localized at its center. It falls off exponentially over here. And correspondingly, we have some gravitational potential that you can just work out, phi 1. The only extra complication here is because we're dealing with a vector, we have an additional unit vector in our solution, which is just telling us which direction the vector field points within the dark photon field points within the soliton. So as I mentioned, yep, you usually get the energy density in terms of this field profile psi I, and it's localized at its center. And once we've got this basic ansatz for our solution, we can get all other solutions for solitons of different masses just by doing some rescaling. You rescale the field profile, the gravitational potential, and the binding energy. And for any mass, we can find the corresponding soliton. One kind of interesting fact is that the combination of the mass of the soliton times its size r is invariant, or is unchanged under this rescaling. So it just depends on the mass of the dark photon. If I have a more massive soliton, it's smaller in size, and vice versa. And finally, for a fixed m, there's of course an infinite set of solutions parameterized by this ui. So in practice, the soliton solutions look something. Let's just pick this direction won't be able to sketch it so well, but you kind of have your vector field pointing like this in a single direction throughout. There are other solutions or soliton-like solutions for vector fields. For example, you can construct a hedgehog-like thing with the vector field pointing out in different directions from the center. These things seem to always have higher energy and seem not to be realized actually in the cosmological evolution. I haven't managed to prove, like in a mathematical sense, that this is the ground state energy solution, but it seems pretty plausible from kind of symmetry arguments and so on. And indeed from simulations, which do just show you that everything that forms is going to be like this. Okay, but so all of those arguments, I think, work. And sorry.
Here you are plotting the vector field.
So this would be like, yeah, AI that I'm plotting.
So is it rotating or like is it oscillating?
So the non-relativistic part, psi I goes as, let's go back to one slide actually, just has this form, so the direction stays the same in terms of field space. Each individual component is oscillating in this way, just from the binding energy, if you like. But once it's kind of picked a direction, it seems to stay fixed. So despite these arguments being kind of convincing, of course, if you actually want to do something quantitative, know how much of the dark matter is bound into these solitons, it's not enough. And as in many of my projects, I end up doing simulations, but in this case, they're not actually too bad. So we take our Schrodinger Poisson solution set of equations, we put it on some discrete lattice. We start with a realization of the initial conditions at early times, long before matter radiation equality, and then we just evolve forward. And we stop once we can no longer resolve the soliton cores because we're working on a discrete lattice. Okay, now I can show you some simulation results. Okay, so on the left-hand side, I have a two-dimensional slice through the field profile. We do full three-dimensional simulations, but I've just taken a 2D slice. The colors represent the dark matter density compared to the mean dark matter density. So sort of mid-blue is about no over-density, just density of about the, as I say, mean density. Lambda star is the scale of the initially order one fluctuations. You can see here that we have a bit of variation, roughly, and this is on a log scale. Then on the right-hand side, as you look at it, I plot the largest density anywhere in the simulation as a function of time. So A over A equality, time will go in that direction. And this is normalized by the mean dark matter density at matter radiation equality. So if everything was just redshifting following the Hubble expansion, I would expect a straight line following rho bar. But then once clumps are forming, they should decouple from Hubble flow. Okay, now I can play this forward and see what happens. So initially at times before matter radiation equality, nothing too interesting is happening. You can see that maybe something is starting to form here, but mostly the overdensities are just oscillating, probably driven partly by quantum pressure. And the maximum density in the simulation is just decreasing, mostly following Hubble flow. But now we've got to a time at around matter radiation equality, interesting things should instead happen. So if we evolve forward a bit more, you can see that we're now forming a collapsed object in the center. One of these clumps has actually become gravitationally bound and decoupled from Hubble flow. And then evolving further forward in time, see that indeed the, you see that indeed we have a small, well, small overdensity, spatially small in terms of size and large in terms of the actual overdensity sat in the middle. It's not just isolated, but it's surrounded by some sort of halo around it, which is maybe not too surprising. We don't just expect isolated solitons, but there should be dark matter attracted to them. And on the right-hand side, you can see that it's been produced with some sort of quasi-normal modes, which you can also see from the density picture. There's these sort of waves being emitted out of it, just corresponding to these oscillations. The density is a bit bigger than the mean density at matter radiation equality by about a factor of 100. This is partly just because the initial fluctuation is a bit bigger than 1. and partly because the density increases a bit during the collapse just here. Okay, so that's the picture, but then of course you want to study the data a bit more convincing, in a bit more detail. It actually works on this. Anyway, so one thing you can do is you can do a few simulations, extract all of the objects that form and look at their spherically averaged density profile. What I do here is take the density profile around each object and I normalize it by the density at the center, and then I plot in terms of the distance from the center in units of the quantum gene's length associated to the center. The point of this is that for all of the soliton solutions with different masses, this profile in terms of these units takes a universal form, let's say, which is the black dashed line. And then the blue dashed line is the results averaging over all of the different objects that form. So you can see that indeed we are actually forming objects with these soliton-like solutions. You know, it matches perfectly here. And then there's a bit of a deviation at the end that I'll come back to in a couple of slides. And all of them, going back to the earlier point, look of this form. There's none that sort of survive in this form. Maybe there's some that form sort of transiently like this, but they pretty quickly decay. You can also, if you like, check the quantum pressure compared to the gravitational potential, and indeed you get this balancing where the two cancel each other out. There's basically no angular momentum, at least in the cores of these objects. They're purely supported by quantum pressure. We're also interested in the mass distribution. So here I plot the fraction of dark matter that is in solitons as a function of the soliton mass, normalizing to the mass at matter radiation equality that we expect for an order one fluctuation. The purple is a sort of analytic prediction that we did based on a study of the initial density field, the spatial distribution of the field at early times. This has one parameter that we kind of adjust to match the simulation results. And then the blue are the simulation results at different times, different scale factors after matter radiation equality. So as I kind of anticipated earlier, at later times, lighter and lighter solitons are being produced, which corresponds to the quantum gene scale moving further to the right, and objects at smaller and smaller scales being able to collapse. Again, yep, so as I said, the typical mass is something like 10 to the minus 15 solar masses for m of order 10 to the minus 5, and the typical size of these objects is something like 10 to the 6 kilometers, again for masses of 10 to the minus 5 electron volts. And the typical densities are at most something like 1,000 electron volts to the 4, with maybe more at around 10 or 100.
In the previous slide, for the profile, scalar.
So for a scalar, it would be exactly the same. This solution is basically the scalar one, just picking one individual direction in field space. There's nothing complicated. Yeah, there seems to be no lower state that we can access. As we saw from the video, these aren't just isolated solitons, but they're surrounded by some sort of halo. This is exactly the same plot as last time, but now putting a log scale on the x-axis. So you see we have the soliton-like region, and then outside it we have an NFW kind of profile, which we call a fuzzy halo because in this it's partly supported by quantum pressure, but also partly supported by velocity, angular momentum, which isn't so surprising that there's some sort of transition between the soliton and the smooth background dark matter. The soliton, after all, is only an exact solution in a vacuum, and we're not in a vacuum. It should attract dark matter to it. Okay, now moving to the modes in this part of the spectrum. As mentioned, these things will grow and collapse, but they're going to grow and collapse in a regime that is far from where quantum pressure matters, so they're going to form into mostly classical-like halos. The quantum pressure isn't relevant. They're going to contain some of the soliton. They'll contain actually quite a lot of the dark photon dark matter. And this continues with modes on larger and larger spatial scales, collapsing, growing and reaching non-perturbativity, and then collapsing until eventually these extrapolated adiabatic modes grow themselves enough that we can start with the usual hierarchical structure formation. And overall, we get some sort of picture where we have solitons floating around, some of which are bound inside these compact halos of dark photons, which are themselves bound in adiabatic halos. Of course, we also want to know whether these objects actually survive to the present day. It's not that interesting if they form at matter radiation equality but get subsequently destroyed. I won't go through all of the details because it's not the most maybe exciting of computations, but there's various ways that the substructure can be destroyed, for example by tidal forces from some central potential if the solitons are bound inside a compact halo or an adiabatic halo. You can also have dynamical friction, which causes the orbits of the objects to decay and fall into the center of the object where they'll be destroyed. There's possible collisions with stars, which can tidally disrupt them. There's tidal shocks by the galactic disk, or during formation of halos and merging of halos together. But the basic summary is that, as far as we can tell, our calculations aren't perfect. We have to make approximations and some estimations. But as long as we're in some region where the mean density of the clump is bigger than, say, 0.05 electron volts to the 4, we expect that a good fraction of the substructure will actually survive all the way to the present day and be potentially observable. So the solitons have densities of like 0.1 to 100 electron volts to the 4. So most we think will probably survive unless they get bound into a compact halo very soon after they form, in which case maybe they might get disrupted. The compact halos, on the other hand, coming from this K-cubed part of the initial density power spectrum, are much more likely to be disrupted. They, on average, have much lower densities. It could be that the cores of these compact halos survive, or maybe you could get some interesting effects from like streams or something like that. But as sort of complete objects, I suspect most are probably going to go. Okay, having done that, we can now look at some sort of, get towards observable effects. I should say that a complication about the inflation reproduction is it's not straightforward to couple the dark photon to the standard model. Jim Wu could probably tell you a lot about this, but even from the perspective of understanding the dynamics during inflation, any coupling to the standard model potentially changes the story. And I think there's actually some useful work to be done to understand what would happen. But modulo that concern, let's just go forward and see, in principle, are these things observable? So the dark photon star number density is something like this, 10 to the 20 per cubic parsec. If something like 0.05, so 5% of the dark matter is bound into solitons, that's pretty conservative. It could be a factor of 2 or something larger. And then just a factor of the local dark mass density, of course, and then the typical mass scale and the mass of the dark photon enters. This means that the encounter rate of the solitons themselves with the Earth is pretty small. I was hoping it would be maybe a factor of 10 or something larger, but for masses of about an electron volt, you expect maybe one soliton core colliding with the Earth per year. Maybe slightly better if I've been a bit too conservative with this fraction that gets bound. On the other hand, you can have much more frequent encounters if you allow not just the soliton core, but also the fuzzy halo, this NFW part around it, to encounter the Earth. And if you imagine you have some sort of idealized detector which can see the dark photon by some sort of interaction, which hopefully doesn't mess up the earlier dynamics, the density that the detector will experience compared to the mean local dark matter density as a function of time looks something like this. So this is time on the x-axis. And then the different lines correspond to collisions between the detector and solitons with different impact parameters. So if we hit the soliton head-on, which is what this encounter rate, well, reasonably head-on, which is what this encounter rate measures, you would see a gradual ramping up of the dark matter density, followed by a region of about, let's say, about two minutes probably, during which it's seeing a completely coherent soliton-like field with a much higher density than the local dark matter density, and then a gradual fall off. I don't know whether the coherence of the dark photon field during the time it interacts with the soliton actually matters for any of the experiments that are being done at the moment for masses of around electron volt, but it's potentially interesting. Maybe this is something that you could imagine an experiment might be able to utilize somehow. Meanwhile, you also get collisions with just the fuzzy halos kind of grazing the outskirts of the soliton, where you'd see a peak density that was somewhat lower, maybe like 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 compared to the local dark matter density. But of course, just because of the geometric factors, these are much more frequent than the collisions with the solitons themselves. Again, as I mentioned, we haven't really looked at the signals in detail yet. But if you consider that inflationary production could populate this part of the parameter space, you might imagine that for masses of around an electron volt, you could get typical, you get collisions with detectors reasonably frequently. Another kind of interesting thing is that even for dark photon masses above an electron volt, even though most of the dark photon dark matter floating around the universe would now no longer be wave-like as far as its occupation number is concerned, you would still form dark photon stars, and these things would still be wave-like, even though, so you'd have sort of mostly particle-like dark matter, apart from these rare objects floating around where the wave-like effects were relevant. So potentially I could push my signals up towards this direction, where the collisions with the solitons would be much more frequent, just because of the way that the previous results were scaling. Going to lower masses, maybe signals with detectors are less exciting. It would just be too rare to ever see anything interesting. But you might hope that you might occasionally get collisions with white dwarfs or with neutron stars. The other thing, again, going back to one of the early slides, is this in some sense is a toy example. I expect that both in production from the local strings or production from parametric resonance, the time when the Hubble parameter is equal to the mass of the dark photon is playing a crucial role. In some sense, aside from misalignment production, really the only thing you can do in any of these light-dark matter, the only scale available to you in any production mechanism is the scale K-star, so you might think that it's going to appear pretty often. Just considering the dark photon for the moment, if we could have production from a string network or from an axion populating this part of parameter space, then correspondingly you can get much larger dark photon star masses. There I've switched to M being normalized by electron volts, but you can see that if I go down to, say, 10 to the minus 10 electron volts, I get a much larger clump mass, potentially opening windows to, say, gravitational signals or something like that. Of course, you need to worry about the finite size effects when you're calculating these things, but it's at least plausible that in the future there might be some observable signals. Okay, finally, just want to do a bit of advertisement for post-inflationary axions, or axion-like particles. I think these are, in some sense, a kind of neglected part of the axion and axion-like particle parameter space, and actually are much more interesting than people give them credit for. I won't go through the details of the story because it's probably very familiar to lots of people here and I haven't got time. But if I have such a particle, then at early times I form a network of strings. Then when the Hubble parameter is equal to the mass of the axion, I form domain walls. And depending on the domain wall number, I might just get all the domain walls decaying at this point. Alternatively, if the domain wall number is bigger than one, they can survive for some time and then be destroyed at the time when the Hubble parameter is smaller, let's say h is equal to hd by definition, just by some sort of explicit breaking of the Petrikin symmetry that is giving rise to the axion. The first interesting thing about these particles, which probably quite a few people in the world realize, but maybe isn't said so often, is that they can easily have large couplings to photons. So modulo interesting results from Pratik and people about compatibility with guts and things. If such an axion-like particle has a coupling to photons anomaly coefficient of order 1, then you can easily populate this part of parameter space, which is actually much easier to search for than, say, either the QCD axion or a normal pre-inflationary axion-like particle with, say, misalignment angle of order 1, unless you sort of go to a large misalignment regime, which is certainly interesting, but it's still a bit low, I think, typically. So potentially people who are building experiments should be aware that they are actually potentially searching interesting parameter space. More connected to this talk, we expect that the density power spectrum that the axions are produced is going to have this kind of form. So if we have domain wall number n is equal to 1, I think it should be peaked at around k star because this is the scale on which the domain walls are, the size of the domain walls when they're decaying. And again, just like the dark photon case, this is going to be automatically for a temperature-independent outmass in a regime where quantum pressure marginally matters. So these initial overdensities should, just like the dark photon, collapse down into axion stars. On the other hand, if I have an anomaly coefficient n bigger than 1, so the domain walls decay later after when h is equal to h star, gradually the power spectrum shifts over to the left with the k peak compared to the quantum gene scale going in this form. So HD is smaller than MA in this case. And I'm moving away from the case where we're forming axion stars into a regime where we're forming kind of classical halos, mini clusters, things like that. If you look at the masses of the ALP stars that you could form upstars or compact halos that you could form this way over the parameter space that I showed in the previous plot. It could potentially range between something like 100 solar masses down to 10 to the minus 22 solar masses in different parts of this parameter space. So there's potentially a nice complementarity. If a axion direct detection experiment discovered something over here, which you could discover reasonably soon because it's not too hard in terms of the photon coupling, you'd then have a prediction for the substructure mass that you might hope to see in gravitational signals. Down here in this part of parameter space, the quantum pressure will dominate, so you'll either get no collapse or collapse into axion stars. And then as you go up in this plot, you'll form into classical halos rather than axion stars. A final kind of fun thing about this is that there is a critical mass above which a axion star is probably unstable. This is due to the self-interactions, assuming it has an attractive quartic interaction of this kind of form. When you put in the numbers, the critical mass is kind of comparable to the masses that you expect over in this part of parameter space. So potentially we could be forming axion stars that are sort of on the edge of being unstable, maybe with a bit of accretion or growth in the later universe. Potentially this could push them over the edge of stability. They could then explode and potentially give off some sort of relativistic axion signal that might be observable. This is much more... Okay, so the top edges from isocurvature bounds, as I go too far over to the left, I then get close to the adiabatic modes and in conflict with like Lyman alpha or whatever. And then the lower edges, just because I, in some sense, produce some irreducible amount from the strings in this scenario. So I can't make the abundance too small. Of course, I can make the coupling to photons smaller just by changing my theory, but assuming E is roughly of order one. Okay, I think this, sorry. Interesting, yeah. Maybe this tells you that... Yeah. Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. I guess, I mean, in some sense, the fact that the domain walls are there and interacting is telling you the axion potential is important at these times. So certainly if this is exceeded, you won't form the axion stars and then they'll explode. Yeah. It's going to matter the whole way through. So the dark matter abundance does go into this via the Hubble parameter at the time when the network is destroyed. So over this parameter space, I'm imposing that omega is equal, dark matter is equal to omega A. The question is, I agree there's some... A bit surprising that self-interactions would matter in the stars, but not later. I think I have to, maybe I have to think about that. Don't have an immediate answer. Okay. I know that's pretty much all I wanted to say. So I think the conclusions are just that wave-like dark matter can have interesting substructure. And given the experimental effort, this is worth understanding. Dark photons produced by inflationary fluctuations provide a nice minimal theory, potentially in conflict with swampland conjectures if you care about them, but actually if you just want some theory that you can calculate in, then it's really quite nice. We see that solitonic dark photon stars automatically form in this case because of some parametric coincidence between the scale at which quantum pressure is relevant and the scale at which the fluctuations are created, potentially containing something like 5 or 10% of the dark matter abundance. And there's plenty of things for us to do in the future. We need to look at the observable signals in more detail, potentially corresponding covering the whole kind of mass range, given that there's other production mechanisms that might be relevant. And it's also interesting to think about similar dynamics for other dark photon production mechanisms and axions, ALPS. Okay, thanks. Yes. I don't know. Short answer, yeah, I think work to be done is to understand the inflationary production in the case where you have couplings to other fields. Actually, also in the case where there's plenty of things to be worked out there. Yes, yes. Okay, so this is the earlier part that you get these fluctuations inevitably during inflation. It's just unavoidable. And if you have a sufficiently high Hubble scale during inflation, you can't avoid producing these fluctuations. It turns out, and the interesting thing that Peter Graham et al. Did is show that you produce the spectrum such that it's not ruled out by isocurvature constraints in the way that it would be for a scalar, for example. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This would be the picture for the long-lived case, at least. The n is equal to 1 case, you could just have this part and it destroys the variables immediately. But on general grounds anyway, we expect that there should be some additional breakings. Me. Yeah, it depends on the part of parameter space. Also depends what you think the gravitational breaking is, whether it's e to the log or e to the fa over m Planck. I think there's still some discussion there about contributions. Yeah.